the safe position. 10 minutes later, the team was outside and at the edge of the tree line, everyone with binoculars, checking out the building.
"I guess this here's the right side of the tracks," Homer Johnston observed.
"Lots of windows, Dieter."
"Yeah," the German sniper agreed.
"Where you want us, boss?" Homer asked Chavez.
"Far side, both sides. Crossfire on the chopper pad. Right now, people, and when you're set up, give me radio calls to check in. You know the drill."
"Everything we see, we call to you, Herr Major," Weber confirmed.
Both snipers got their locked rifle cases and headed off to where the local cops had their cars.
"Do we have a layout of the house?" Chavez asked Altmark.
"Layout?" the Austrian cop asked.
"Diagram, map, blueprints," Ding explained.
"Ah, yes, here."
Altmark led them to his car.
Blueprints were spread on the hood.
"Here, as you see, 46 rooms, not counting the basements."
"Christ," Chavez reacted at once.
"More than one basement?"
"Three. Two under the west wing. Wine cellar and cold storage. East wing basement is unused. The doors down to it may be sealed. No basement under the center portion. The Schloss was built in the late 18th century. Exterior walls and some interior ones are stone."
"Christ, it's a frickin' castle," Ding observed.
"That is what the word Schloss means, Herr Major," Altmark informed him.
"Doc?"
Bello came over.
"From what Captain Altmark tells me, they've been pretty businesslike to this point. No hysterical threats. They gave a deadline of midnight for movement to the airport. Else they say they will start killing hostages."
"Their language is German, with a German accent, you said, Captain?"
Altmark nodded.
"Yeah, they are German, not Austrian. We have only one name, Herr Wolfgang. That is generally a Christian name, not a surname in our language. And we have no known criminal terrorist by that name or pseudonym. Also, he said they are of the Red Workers faction, but we have no word on that organization either."
"Neither did Rainbow."
"So, we don't know very much?" Chavez asked Bello.
"Not much at all, Ding."
"Okay," the psychiatrist went on.
"What does that mean?"
"It means they are planning to survive this one. It means they're serious businessmen in this game. If they threaten to do something, they will try to do it. They haven't killed anyone yet, and that also means they're pretty smart. No other demands made to this point. They will be coming, probably soon."
"How do you know that?" Altmark asked.
The absence of demands to this point had surprised him.
"When it gets dark, they'll be talking with us more. See how they haven't turned any lights on inside the building?"
"Yes, and what does that mean?"
"It means they think the darkness is their friend, and that means they will try to make use of it. Also, the midnight deadline. When it gets dark, we'll be closer to that."
"Full moon tonight," Price observed, "and not much cloud cover."
"Yeah," Ding noted in some discomfort when he looked up at the sky.
"Captain, do you have any searchlights we can use?"
"The fire department will have them," Altmark said.
"Could you please order them brought here?"
"Yeah." "Herr Doctor?"
"Yes," Bello said.
"They said that if they do not have those things done by midnight, they will begin to kill hostages. Do you—"
"Yes, Captain, we have to take that threat very seriously. As I said, these folks are acting like serious people, well-trained and well-disciplined. We can make that work for us."
"How?" Altmark asked. Ding answered.
"We give them what they want. We let them think that they are in control, until it is time for us to take control. We feed their pride and their egos while we have to, and then, later, we stop doing it at a time that suits us."
Osterman's house staff was feeding the terrorists' bodies and their egos.
Sandwiches had been made under the supervision of Ferkner's team and brought around by deeply frightened staff members. Predictably, Osterman's employees were not in a mood to eat, though their guests were. Things had gone well to this point, Hans and Petra thought. They had their primary hostage under tight control, and his lackeys were now in the same room, with easy access to Osterman's personal bathroom. Hostages needed such access, and there was no sense in denying it to them. Otherwise, it stripped them of their dignity and made them desperate. That was inadvisable. Desperate people did foolish things, and what Hans and Petra needed, at the moment, was control over their every action. Gerhard Dengler sat in a visitor's chair directly across the desk from his employer. He knew he'd gotten the police to respond, and, like his boss, he was now wondering if that was a good or a bad thing. In another 2 years, he would have been ready to strike out on his own, probably with Osterman's blessing. He'd learned much from his boss, the way a general's aide learns at the right hand of the senior officer. Though he'd been able to pursue his own destiny much more quickly and surely than a junior officer, what did he owe this man? What was required by this situation? Dengler was no more suited to this than Herr Osterman was, but Dengler was younger, fitter. One of the secretaries was weeping silently, the tears trickling down her cheeks from fear and from the rage of having her comfortable life upset so cruelly. What was wrong with these two that they thought they could invade the lives of ordinary people and threaten them with death? And what could she do about it? The answer to that was nothing. She was skilled at routing calls, processing voluminous paperwork, keeping track of Herr Osterman's money so ably that she was probably the best-paid secretary in the country, because Herr Osterman was a generous boss, always with a kind word for his staff. He'd helped her and her husband, a stonemason, with their investments, to the point that they would soon be millionaires in their own right. She'd been with him long before his first wife had died of cancer, had watched him suffer through that, unable to help him do anything to ease the horrible pain. And then she'd rejoiced at his discovery of Ursel von Prinze, who'd allowed Herr Osterman to smile again. Who were these people who stared at them as though they were objects, with guns in their hands like something from a movie? Except that she and Gerhardt and the others were the bit players now. They couldn't go to the kitchen to fetch beer and pretzels. They could only live the drama to its end. And so she wept quietly at her powerlessness, to the contempt of Petra Dortmund. Homer Johnson was in his ghillie suit, a complex overall-type garment made of rags sewn into place on a gridded matrix, whose purpose was to make him appear to be a bush or a pile of leaves or compost. Anything but a person with a rifle. The rifle was set up on its bipod, the hinged flaps on the front and back lenses of his telescopic sight flipped up. He'd picked a good place to the east of the helicopter pad that would allow him to cover the entire distance between the helicopter and the house. His laser rangefinder announced that he was 216 meters from a door on the back of the house and 147 meters from the front left door of the helicopter. He was lying prone in a dry spot on the beautiful lawn, in the lengthening shadows close to the tree line, and the air brought to him the smell of horses, which reminded him of his childhood in the American Northwest. Okay. He thumbed his radio microphone. Lead. Rifle 2-1. Rifle 2-1, lead. In place and set up. I show no movement in the house at this time. Rifle 2-2, in place and set up. I also see no movement, Sergeant Weber reported from his spot, 256 meters from Johnston. Johnston turned to see Dieter's location. His German counterpart had selected a good spot. "Achtung!" a voice called behind him.
Johnston turned to see an Austrian cop approaching, not quite crawling on the grass. "Here," the man said, handing over some photos and withdrawing rapidly. Johnston looked at them. Good, shots of the hostages. But none of the bad guys. Well, at least he'd know whom not to shoot. With that, he backed off the rifle and lifted his green-coated military binoculars and began scanning the house slowly and regularly, left to right and back again.
Dieter, he said over his direct radio link.
Yes, Homer.
They get you the photos?
Yes, I have them.
No lights inside.
Yeah, our friends are being clever.
I figure about half an hour until we have to go NVG.
I agree, Homer.
Johnston grunted and turned to check the bag he'd carried in along with his rifle case and $10,000 rifle. Then he returned to scanning the building, patiently, like staking out a mountain deer trail for a big muley. A happy thought for the lifelong hunter. The taste of venison, especially cooked in the field over an open wood fire. Some coffee from the blue steel-enameled pot. And the talking that came after a successful hunt.
Well, you can't eat what you shoot here, Homer, the sergeant told himself, settling back into his patient routine. One hand reached into a pocket for some beef jerky to chew. Eddie Price lit his pipe on the far side of the dwelling. Not as big as Kensington Palace, but prettier, he thought. The thought disturbed him. It was something they'd talked about during his time in the SAS. What if terrorists, usually they thought of the Irish PIRA or INLA, attacked one of the royal residences, or the Palace of Westminster? The SAS had walked through all of the buildings in question at one time or another, just to get a feel for the layout, the security systems, and the problems involved. Especially after that lunatic had cracked his way into Buckingham Palace in the 1980s, walking into the Queen's own bedchamber. He still had chills about that. The brief reverie faded. He had the Schloss Ostermann to worry about, Price remembered, scanning over the blueprints again.
Bloody nightmare on the inside, Ding, Price finally said.
That's the truth. All wood floors, probably creak. Lots of places for the bad guys to hide and snipe at us. We'd need a chopper to do this right.
But they didn't have a helicopter.
That was something to talk with Clark about. Rainbow hadn't been fully thought through. Too fast on too many things. Not so much that they needed a helicopter as some good chopper crews trained in more than one type of aircraft, because when they deployed in the field, there was no telling what machines would be used by their host nation.
Chavez turned.
Doc?
Bellow came over.
Yes, Ding?
I'm starting to think about letting them out. Walk to the helicopter behind the house, and taking them down that way rather than forcing our way in.
A little early for that, isn't it?
Chavez nodded.
Yeah, it is, but we don't want to lose a hostage, and come midnight, you said, we have to take that threat seriously.
We can delay it some, maybe. My job to do that over the phone.
I understand. But if we make a move, I want it to be in the dark.
That means tonight.
I can't plan on having you talk them into surrender unless you're thinking different.
Possible, but unlikely, Bellow had to agree.
He couldn't even speak confidently about delaying the threatened midnight kill.
Next, we have to see if we can spike the building.
I'm here, Noonan said.
Tall order, man.
Can you do it?
I can probably get close unobserved, but there's over 100 windows. And how the hell can I get to the ones on the second and third floors? Unless I do a dangle from a chopper and come down on the roof.
And that meant making sure that the local TV people, who'd show up as predictably as vultures over a dying cow, turned their cameras off and kept them off, which then ran the risk of alerting the terrorists when the TV reporters stopped showing the building of interest.
and how could they fail to note that a helicopter had flown 30 feet over the roof of the building? And might there be a bad guy on the roof, already keeping watch?
"This is getting complicated," Chavez observed quietly.
"Dark and cold enough for the thermal viewers to start working," Noonan said helpfully.
"Yeah."
Chavez picked up his radio mic. "Team, lead. Go thermal. Say again, break out the thermals." Then he turned.
"What about cell phones?"
Noonan could do little more than shrug. There were now something like 300 civilians gathered around, well back from the Osterman property and controlled by local police. But most of them had a view of the house and the grounds. And if one of them had a cell phone and someone inside did as well, all that unknown person outside had to do was dial his buds on the inside to tell them what was going down. There were now something like 300 civilians gathered around, well back from the Osterman property and controlled by local police. But most of them had a view of the house and the grounds, and if one of them had a cell phone, and someone inside did as well, all that unknown person outside had to do was dial his buds on the inside to tell them what was going down. The miracle of modern communication worked both ways. There were over 500 cellular frequencies, and the gear to cover them all was not part of Rainbow's regular kit. No terrorist or criminal operation had yet used that technique, to the best of their knowledge, but they couldn't all be dumb and stay dumb, could they? Chavez looked over at the Schloss and thought again that they'd have to get the bad guys outside for this to work properly. Problem with that? He didn't know how many bad guys he'd have to deal with, and he had no way of finding out without spiking the building to gather additional information, which was a dubious undertaking for all the other reasons he'd just considered. "Tim, make a note for when we get back about dealing with cellular phones and radios outside the objective. Captain Altmark."
"Yes, Major Chavez?"
"The lights, are they here yet?"
"Just arrived, yeah. We have 3 sets.
Altmark pointed. Price and Chavez went over to look. They saw 3 trucks with attachments that looked for all the world like the lights one might see around a high school football field. Meant to help fight a major fire, they could be erected and powered by the trucks that carried them. Chavez told Altmark where he wanted them and returned to the team's assembly point. The thermal viewers relied on difference in temperature to make an image. The evening was cooling down rapidly, and with it the stone walls of the house. Already the windows were glowing more brightly than the walls, because the house was heated, and the old-style full-length windows in the building's many doors were poorly insulated, despite the large drapes that hung just inside each one. Dieter Weber made the first spot. "Lead, Rifle 2-2, I have a thermal target first floor, 4th window from the west, looking around the curtains at the outside."
"Okay, that's one in the kitchen."
It was the voice of Hank Patterson, who was hovering over the blueprints.
"That's number 1.
Can you tell me anything else, Dieter?"
"Negative, just a shape," the German sniper replied.
"No, wait. Tall, probably a man."
"This is Pierce. I have one, 1st floor, east side, 2nd window from east wall."
"Captain Altmark?"
"Yeah?"
"Could you call Osterman's office, please? We want to know if he's there."
"Because if he were, there would be 1 or 2 bad guys in with him."
"Osterman office," a woman's voice answered.
"This is Captain Altmark. Who is this?"
"This is Commander Gertrude of the Red Workers faction."
"Excuse me, I was expecting to speak to Commander Wolfgang."
"Wait," Petra's voice told him.
"Hier ist Wolfgang."
"Hier ist Altmark. We have not heard from you in a long time.
What news do you have for us?"
"No news, but we do have a request, Herr Commander."
"Yes, what is it?"
"As a sign of good faith," Altmark said, with Dr. Bellow listening in, a translator next to him,
We request that you release two of your hostages from the domestic staff, perhaps.
Wofür?
So they can help you identify us? Lead. Lincoln here. I have a target. Northwest corner window. Tall, probably male. That's 3+2, Chavez observed, as Patterson placed a yellow circle sticker on that part of the prints. The woman who'd answered the phone had remained on the line as well. "You have 3 hours until we send you a hostage, tot," she emphasized. "You have any further requests?" "We require a pilot for Herr Ostermann's helicopter before midnight, and an airliner waiting at the airport. Otherwise, we will kill a hostage to show that we are quite serious, and then thereafter at regular intervals. Do you understand?" "Please, we respect your seriousness here," Altmark assured her. "We are looking for a flight crew now, and we have discussions underway with Austrian Airlines for the aircraft. These things take time, you know." "You always say that, people like you." "We have told you what we require. If you do not meet those requirements, then their blood is on your hands." "Ende," the voice said, and the line went dead. Captain Altmark was both surprised and discomforted by the cold decisiveness on the other end of the phone, and by the abrupt termination of the call. He looked up at Paul Bellow as he replaced the receiver. "Herr Doctor?" "The woman is the dangerous one. They're both smart. They've definitely thought this one through, and they will kill a hostage to make their point, sure as hell." "Man and woman team," Price was saying over the phone. "German, ages late 30s, early 40s, as a guess. Maybe older. Bloody serious," he added for Bill Tawney. "Thanks, Eddie. Stand by," came the reply. Price could hear the fingers tapping on the keyboard. "Okay, lad, I have three possible teams for you. Uploading them now." "Thank you, sir." Price opened his laptop again. "Ding?" "Yeah?" "Intelligence coming in." "We have at least 5 tears in there, boss," Patterson said, moving his finger around the prints. "Too quick for them to move around. Here, 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 and 2 upstairs here. The placement makes sense. They probably have portable radios, too. The house is too big for them to communicate by shouting around at each other." Noonan heard that and went off to his radio intercept equipment. If their friends were using handheld radios, then their frequency range was well known, determined by international treaty, in fact, probably not the military sets the team used, and probably not encrypted. In seconds, he had his computerized scanner set up and working off multiple antennas, which would allow him to triangulate on sources inside the house. These were coupled into his laptop computer, already overlaid with a diagram of the Schloss. 3 spear carriers was about right, Noonan thought. 2 was too few. 3 was close to the right number, though the truck in front of the building could have easily held more. 2+3, 2+4, 2+5. But they'd all be planning to leave, and the helicopter wasn't all that big. That made the total terrorist count at 5 to 7. A guess. And they couldn't go with a guess. Well, they'd prefer not to. But it was a starting place. So many guesses. What if they were not using portable radios? What if they used cell phones? What if a lot of things, Noonan thought. You had to start somewhere, gather all the information you could, and then act on it. The problem with people like this was that they always decided the pace of the event. For all their stupidity and their criminal intent, which Noonan regarded as a weakness, they did control the pace. They decided when things happened. The team could alter it a little by cajolery. That was Dr. Bellow's part. But when you got down to it, well, the bad guys were the only ones willing to do murder. And that was a card that made a noise when it came down on the table. There were 10 hostages inside, Ostermann,
his 3 business assistants, and 6 people who looked after the house and grounds. Every one of them had a life and a family, and the expectation to keep both. Team 2's job was to make sure that happened. But the bad guys still controlled too much, and this special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation didn't like that very much. Not for the first time, he wished he was one of the shooters, able, in due course, to go in and execute the takedown. But, good as he was at weapons and the physical side, he was better trained on the technical aspects of the mission. That was his area of personal expertise, and he served the mission best by sticking with his instruments. He didn't, however, have to like it.
So, what's the score, Ding?
Not all that good, Mr. C.
Chavez turned to survey the building again. Very difficult to approach the building because of the open ground, therefore difficult to spike and get tactical intelligence. We have 2 primary and probably 3 secondary subjects who seem professional and serious. I'm thinking in terms of letting them out to go to the helicopter and taking them down then. Snipers in place. But with the number of subjects, this might not be real pretty, John.
Clark looked at the display in his command center. He had continuous comm links with Team 2, including their computer displays. As before, Peter Covington was beside him to kibitz.
"Might as well be a moated bloody castle," the British officer had observed earlier.
He'd also noted the need for helicopter pilots as a permanent part of the team.
"One other thing," Chavez said. "Noonan says we need jamming gear for the cell phone freaks. We have a few hundred civilians around, and if one has a shoe phone, he can talk to our friends inside, tell them what we're doing. No way in hell we can prevent that without jamming gear. Write that one down, Mr. C."
"Noted, Domingo," Clark replied, looking over at David Peled, his chief technical officer.
"I can take care of that in a few days," Peled told his boss.
Mossad had the right sort of equipment. Probably so did some American agencies. He'd find out in a hurry. Noonan, David told himself, was very good for a former policeman.
"Okay, Ding. You are released to execute at discretion. Good luck, my boy."
"Gee, thanks, Dad," was the ironic reply. "Team 2 out." Chavez killed the radio and tossed the microphone back at the box. "Price," he called.
"Yes, sir."
The sergeant major materialized at his side.
"We have discretionary release," the leader told his XO.
"Marvelous, Major Chavez. What do you propose, sir?"
The situation had to be unfavorable, Ding told himself, if Price had reverted back to serving him.
"Well, let's see what we got in the way of assets, Eddie."
Klaus Rosenthal was Osterman's head gardener, and at 71, the oldest member of the domestic staff. His wife was at home, he was sure, in her bed with a nurse in close attendance, handling her medications. And worrying about him, he was sure, and that worry could be dangerous to her. Hilda Rosenthal had a progressive heart condition that had invalidated her over the past 3 years. The state medical system had provided the necessary care for her, and Herr Ostermann had assisted as well, sending a friend of his, a full professor from Vienna's Allgemeine Krankenhaus, to oversee the case. And a new drug therapy treatment had actually improved Hilda's condition somewhat. But the fear she'd be feeling for him now certainly would not help, and that thought was driving Klaus mad. He was in the kitchen, along with the rest of the domestic staff. He'd been inside getting a glass of water when they'd arrived. Had he been outside, he might well have escaped and raised the alarm, and so helped to aid his employer, who'd been so considerate to all his staff, and Hilda. But luck had been against that when these swine had stormed into the kitchen with their weapons showing. Young ones, late 20s, the close one, whose name Rosenthal didn't know,
was either a Berliner or from West Prussia, judging by his accent. And he'd recently been a skinhead, or so it appeared from the uniform-length stubble on his hatless head. A product of the DDR, the now-defunct East Germany. One of the new Nazis who'd grown out of that fallen communist nation. Rosenthal had met the old ones at Belzec concentration camp as a boy. And though he'd managed to survive that experience, the return of the terror of having one's life continue only at the whim of a madman with cruel, pig-like eyes. Rosenthal closed his eyes. He still had the nightmares that went along with the 5-digit number tattooed on his forearm. Once a month he still awoke on sweaty sheets after reliving the former reality of watching people march into a building from which no one ever emerged alive. And always in the nightmare, someone with a cruel young SS face beckons to him to follow them in there too, because he needs a shower. "Oh, no," he protests in the dream. "Hauptsturmfuhrer Brandt needs me in the metalworking shop." "Not today, Yuda," the young SS noncom says, with that ghastly smile. "Komm jetzt zu dem Bräucherbad." Every time he walks as bidden, for what else could one do? Right to the door. And then every time he awakes, damp with perspiration, and sure that had he not awakened, he would not have awakened at all, just like all the people he'd watched march that way. There are many kinds of fear, and Klaus Rosenthal had the worst of all. His was the certainty that he would die at the hands of one of them, the bad Germans, the ones who simply didn't recognize or care about the humanity of others, and there was no comfort in the certainty of it. And that kind wasn't all gone, wasn't all dead yet. One was right in his field of view, looking back at him, his machine gun in his hands, looking at Rosenthal and the others in the kitchen like Objekte, mere objects. The other staff members, all Christians, had never experienced this, but Klaus Rosenthal had, and he knew what to expect, and knew that it was a certainty. His nightmare was real, risen from the past to fulfill his destiny, and then also kill Hilda, for her heart would not survive. And what could he do about it? Before, the first time, he'd been an orphaned boy apprentice to a jeweler, where he'd learned to make fine metal items, which trade had saved his life, which trade he'd never followed afterward, so horrid were the memories associated with it. Instead, he found the peace of working in the soil, making living things grow pretty and healthy. He had the gift. Ostermann had recognized it and told him that he had a job for life at this Schloss. But that gift didn't matter to this Nazi with stubbly hair and a gun in his hands. Ding supervised the placement of the lights. Captain Altmark walked with him to each truck. Then they both told the driver exactly where to go. When the light trucks were in place and their light masts raised, Chavez returned to his team and sketched out the plan. It was after 11 now. It was amazing how fast time went when you needed more of it. The helicopter crew was there, mostly sitting still, drinking coffee like good aviators, and wondering what the hell came next. It turned out that the co-pilot had a passing resemblance to Eddie Price, which Ding decided to make use of as a final backup part of his plan. At 11:20, he ordered the lights switched on. The front and both sides of the Schloss were bathed in yellow-white light, but not the back, which projected a triangular shadow all the way to the helicopter and beyond into the trees. "Also," Chavez said, "get over to Dieter and set up close to there." "Roger, Mano." First Sergeant Vega hoisted his M60 onto his shoulder and made his way through the woods. Louis Loisel and George Tomlinson had the hardest part. They were dressed in their night greens. The coveralls over their black ninja suits looked like graph paper,
light green background cross-hatched in darker green lines, making blocks perhaps an eighth-inch square. Some of the blocks were filled with the same dark green in random, squared-off, patternless patterns. The idea dated back to World War II Luftwaffe night fighters whose designers had decided that the night was dark enough, and that black-painted fighter aircraft were easier to spot because they were darker than the night itself. These coveralls worked in principle and in exercises. Now they'd see if they worked in the real world. The blazing lights would help. Aimed at and somewhat over the Schloss, they'd serve to create an artificial well of darkness into which the green suits should disappear. They'd drilled it at Hereford often enough, but never with real lives at risk. That fact notwithstanding, Tomlinson and Loisel moved out from different directions, keeping inside the triangular shadow all the way in. It took them 20 minutes of crawling. "So, Altmark," Hans Ferkner said at 11:45, "are the arrangements set, or must we kill one of our hostages in a few minutes?" "Please do not do that, Herr Wolfgang. We have the helicopter crew on the way now, and we are working with the airline to get the aircraft released to us and ready for the flight. It is more difficult than you imagine to do these things." "In 15 minutes we shall see how difficult it is, Herr Altmark." And the line went dead. Bello didn't need a translator. The tone was enough. "He will do it," the psychiatrist told Altmark and Chavez. "The deadline is for real." "Get the flight crew out," Ding ordered at once. 3 minutes later, a marked police car approached the helicopter. Two men got out and entered the Sikorsky as the car drove away. 2 minutes after that, the rotor started turning. Then Chavez keyed his command microphone. "Team, this is lead. Stand to. I repeat, stand to." "Excellent," Ferkner said. He could barely see the turning rotor, but the blinking flying lights told the tale. "So, we begin. Herr Ostermann, stand up." Petra Dortmund made her way downstairs ahead of the important hostages. She frowned, wondering if she should be disappointed that they'd not killed this dangler person to show their resolve. That time could come later, when they started the serious interrogation aboard the airliner. And maybe Dangler knew all that Ostermann did. If so, killing him might be a tactical mistake. She activated her radio and called the rest of her people. They were assembling in the foyer as she came down the main staircase, along with the 6 hostages from the kitchen. No, she decided at the door. It would be better to kill a female hostage. That would have a greater impact on the police forces outside, all the more so if she were killed by another woman. "Are you ready?" Petra asked, receiving nods from the other 4 of her crew. "It will go as we planned," she told them. These people were disappointing ideologically, despite their having grown up and been educated in a proper socialist country. 3 of them even had military training, which had included political indoctrination. But they knew their jobs and had carried them out to this point. She could ask for a little more. The house staff was coming in from the kitchen area. One of the cooks was having trouble walking, and that annoyed the stubble-headed swine, Rosenthal saw, as he stopped by the main food preparation table. They were taking him, he knew, taking him to die, and, as in his nightmare, he was doing nothing. The realization came to him so suddenly as to cause a crippling wave of headache-like pain. His body twisted left, and he saw the table, and on it a small paring knife. His head snapped forward, saw the terrorists looking at Maria, the cook. In that moment, he made his decision, and snapped up the knife, tucking it up his right sleeve.
Perhaps fate would give him a chance. If so, Klaus Rosenthal promised himself, this time he'd take it.
Team 2, this is Lead, Chavez said over the radio links. We should have them start to come out shortly. Everybody check in. He listened to two double clicks, first of all, from Loisel and Tomlinson close to the Schloss, then the names.
Rifle 2-1, Homer Johnston said.
His night vision system was now attached to his telescopic sight and trained rigidly on the building's main rear doors, as the rifleman commanded his breathing into a regular pattern.
Rifle 2-2, Weber called in a second later.
Also, Vega reported. He licked his lips as he brought his weapon up to his shoulder, his face covered with camouflage paint.
Connolly,
Lincoln,
McTyler,
Patterson,
Pierce.
They all reported from their spots on the grass.
Price, the sergeant major reported from the left side front seat of the helicopter.
Okay, team, we are weapons free. Normal rules of engagement in effect. Stay sharp, people, Chavez added unnecessarily.
It was hard for the commander to stop talking in such a case. His position was 80 yards away from the helicopter, marginal range for his MP-10, with his NVGs aimed at the building.
Door opening, Weber reported a fraction before Johnston.
I have movement, Rifle 2-1 confirmed.
Captain Altmark, this is Chavez. Kill the TV feed now, Ding ordered on his secondary radio.
Yeah, I understand, the police captain replied.
He turned and shouted an order at the TV director. The cameras would stay on, but would not broadcast, and the tapes from this point on were considered classified information. The signal going out on the airways now merely showed talking heads.
Door open now, Johnston said from his sniper perch. I see one hostage, looks like a male cook, and a subject, female, dark hair, holding a pistol.
Sergeant Johnston commanded himself to relax, taking his finger off the double-set triggers of his rifle. He couldn't shoot now without a direct order from Ding, and that order would not come in such a situation.
Second hostage in view. It's little man, he said, meaning Dengler.
Osterman was big man, and the female secretaries were Blondie and Brownie, so named for their hair color. They didn't have photos of the domestic staff, hence no names for them. Known bad guys were subjects.
They hesitated at the door, Johnston saw. Had to be a scary time for them, though how scary it was, they would not and could not know.
Too fucking bad, he thought, centering the crosshair reticle on her face from over 200 yards away, which distance was the equivalent of 10 feet for the rifleman.
Come on out, honey, he breathed. We have something real special for you and your friends.
Dieter? He asked, keying his radio.
On target, Homer, Rifle 2-2 replied.
We know this face, I think. I cannot recall the name.
Leader, Rifle 2-2.
Rifle 2, lead.
The female subject, we have seen her face recently. She is older now, but I know this face.
Bader Meinhof, Red Army Faction, one of those, I think. Works with a man.
Marxist, experienced terrorist, murderer. Killed an American soldier, I think.
None of which was particularly breaking news, but a known face was a known face. Price broke in, thinking about the computer morphing program they'd played with earlier in the week.
Petra Dortmund, perhaps?
Yeah, that is the one.
And her partner is Hans Ferkner, Weber replied.
Komm raus, Petra, he went on in his native language. Komm mir, Liebchen.
Something was bothering her.
It turned out to be difficult just to walk out of the Schloss onto the open rear lawn, though she could plainly see the helicopter with its blinking lights and turning rotor. She took a step, or started to, her foot not wanting to make the move out and downward onto the granite steps. Her blue eyes screwed up. Because the trees east and west of the Schloss were lit so brightly by the lights on the far side of the house, with the shadow stretching out to the helicopter like a black finger. And maybe the thing that discomforted her was the death-like image before her. Then she shook her head, disposing of the thought as some undignified superstition. She yanked at her two hostages and made her way down the 6 steps to the grass, then outward toward the waiting aircraft.
"You sure of the ID, Dieter?" Chavez asked.
"Yeah. Yes, I am, sir. Petra Dortmund." Next to Chavez, Dr. Bello queried the name on his laptop. "Age 44, ex-Bader-Meinhof. Very ideological. And the word on her is that she's ruthless as hell. That's 10-year-old information. Looks like it hasn't changed very much. Partner was one Hans Ferkner. They're supposed to be married, in love, whatever, and very compatible personalities. They're killers, Ding."
"For the moment they are," Chavez responded, watching the 3 figures cross the grass.
"She has a grenade in one hand. Looks like a frag," Homer Johnston said next.
"Left hand. Say again, left."
"Confirmed," Weber chimed in. "I see the hand grenade. Pin is in. I repeat, pin is in."
"Great," Eddie Price snarled over the radio. Forstenfeldbruck, all bloody over again, he thought, strapped into the helicopter, which would be holding the grenade and the fool who might pull the bloody pin.
"This is Price. Just one grenade?"
"I only see the one," Johnston replied. "No bulges in her pockets or anything, Eddie. Pistol in her right hand, grenade in her left."
"I agree," Weber said. "She's right-handed," Bello told them over his radio circuit, after checking the known data on Petra Dortmund. "Subject Dortmund is right-handed."
"Which explains why the pistol is there and the grenade in her left," Price told himself. It also meant that if she decided to throw the grenade properly, she'd have to switch hands. Some good news, he thought. Maybe it's been a long time since she played with one of the damn things. Maybe she was even afraid of things that went bang, his mind added, hopefully. Some people just carried the damn things for visual effect. He could see her now, walking at an even pace toward the helicopter.
"Male subject in view. Ferkner," Johnston said over the radio. "He has big man with him. And Brownie also, I think."
"Agree," Weber said, staring through his 10-power sight.
"Subject Ferkner, big man, and Brownie are in sight. Ferkner appears to be armed with pistol only."
"Starting down the steps now. Another subject at the door, armed with submachine gun, 2 hostages with him."
"They're being smart," Chavez observed. "Coming in groups. Our pal started down when his babe was halfway. We'll see if the rest do that."
"Okay," Ding thought. 4, maybe 5 groups traversing the open ground. Clever bastards, but not clever enough. Maybe. As they approached the chopper, Price got out and opened both side doors for loading. He'd already stashed his pistol in the map pocket of the left side co-pilot's door. He gave the pilot a look.
"Just act normally. The situation is under control."
"If you say so, Englishman," the pilot responded, with a rough, tense voice.
"The aircraft does not leave the ground under any circumstances. Do you understand?"
They'd covered that before, but repetition of instructions was the way you survived in a situation like this.
"Yes. If they force me, I will roll it to your side and scream malfunction."
"Bloody decent of you," Price thought.
He was wearing a blue shirt with wings pinned on above the breast pocket and a name tag that announced his name as Tony. A wireless earpiece gave him the radio link to the rest of the team, along with a microphone chip inside his collar.
60 meters away, not a very attractive woman, is she? He asked his teammates.
Brush your hair if you can hear me, Chavez told him from his position. A moment later, he saw Price's left hand go up nervously to push his hair back from his eyes.
Okay, Eddie. Stay cool, man.
Armed subject at the door with 3 hostages, Weber called.
No, 2 armed subjects with 3 hostages. Hostage Blondie is with this one. Old man and middle-aged woman, all dressed as servants.
At least one more bad guy, Ding breathed.
And at least 3 more hostages to come.
Helicopter can't carry all of them.
What were they planning to do with the extras? He wondered.
Kill them?
I see 2 more armed subjects and 3 hostages inside the back door, Johnston reported.
That's all the hostages, Noonan said. Total of 6 subjects, then.
How are they armed, Rifle One?
Submachine guns.
Look like Uzis or the Czech copy of it.
They are leaning toward the door now.
Okay, I got it, Chavez said, holding his own binoculars.
Rifleman, take aim on Subject Dortmund.
On target, Weber managed to say first.
Johnston swiveled to take aim a fraction of a second later, and then he froze still. The human eye is especially sensitive to movement at night. When Johnston moved clockwise to adjust the aim of his rifle, Petra Dortmund thought she might have seen something. It stopped her in her tracks, though she didn't know what it was that had stopped her. She stared right at Johnston. But the ghillie suit just looked like a clump of something. Grass, leaves, or dirt. She couldn't tell in the semi-darkness of green light reflecting off the pine trees. There was no man shape to it, and the outline of the rifle was lost in the clutter well over 100 meters away from her. Even so, she continued to look without moving her gun hand, a look of curiosity on her face, not even visible alarm. Through Johnston's gun sight, the sergeant's open left eye could see the red strobe flashes from the helicopter's flying lights blinking on the ground around him, while the right eye saw the crosshair reticle centered just above and between Petra Dortmund's eyes. His finger was on the trigger now, just barely enough to feel it there, about as much as one could do with so light a trigger pull. The moment lasted into several seconds, and his peripheral vision watched her gun hand most of all. If it moved too much, then... But it didn't. She resumed walking to the helicopter, to Johnston's relief, not knowing that 2 sniper rifles followed her head every centimeter of the way. The next important part came when she got to the chopper. If she went around the right side, Johnston would lose her, leaving her to Weber's rifle alone. If she went left, then Dieter would lose her to his rifle alone. She seemed to be favoring... Yes, Dortmund walked to the left side of the aircraft.
Rifle 2-2 off target, Weber reported at once. I have no shot at this time.
On target, rifle 2-1 is on target, Johnston assured Chavez.
Let little man in first, honey, he thought as loudly as he could.
Petra Dortmund did just that, pushing Dengler in the left side door ahead of her, probably figuring to sit in the middle herself, so as to be less vulnerable to a shot from outside. A good theoretical call, Homer Johnston thought, but off the mark in this case.
Tough luck, bitch.
The comfort of the familiar surroundings of the helicopter was lost on Gerhard Dengler at the moment. He strapped himself in under the aim of Petra's pistol, commanding himself to relax and be brave, as men did at such a time. Then he looked forward and felt hope. The pilot was the usual man, but the co-pilot was not.
Whoever he was fiddling with instruments, as the flight crew did. But it wasn't him, though the shape of head and hair color were much the same. And both wore the white suits with blue epaulets that private pilots tended to adopt as their uniforms. Their eyes met, and Dengler looked down and out of the aircraft, afraid that he'd give something away. Good man, Eddie Price thought. His pistol was in the map pocket in the left side door of the aircraft, well hidden under a pile of flight charts, but easy to reach with his left hand. He'd get it, then turn quickly, bring it up and fire if it came to that. Hidden in his left ear, the radio receiver, which looked like a hearing aid if one saw it, kept him posted, though it was a little hard to hear over the engine and rotor sounds of the Sikorsky. Now Petra's pistol was aimed at himself, or the pilot, as she moved it back and forth. "Rifleman, do you have your targets?" Chavez asked. "Rifle 2-1, affirmative, target in sight." "Rifle 2-2, negative. I have something in the way. Recommend switch to subject Ferkner." "Okay, Rifle 2-2, switch to Ferkner. Rifle 2-1, Dortmund is all yours." "Roger that lead," Johnston confirmed. "Rifle 2-1 has subject Dortmund all dialed in." The sergeant reshot the range with his laser. 144 meters. At this range, his bullet would drop less than an inch from the muzzle, and his battle sight setting of 250 meters was a little high. He altered his crosshairs hold to just below the target's left eye. Physics would do the rest. His rifle had target-type double-set triggers. Pulling the rear trigger reduced the brake pull on the front one to a hard wish, and he was already making that wish. The helicopter would not be allowed to take off. Of more immediate concern, they couldn't allow the subjects to close the left-side door. His 7mm match bullet would probably penetrate the polycarbonate window in the door, but the passage would deflect his round unpredictably, maybe causing a miss, perhaps causing the death or wounding of a hostage. He couldn't let that happen. Chavez was well out of the action now, commanding instead of leading, something he'd practiced but didn't like very much. It was easier to be there with a gun in your hands than to stand back and tell people what to do by remote control. But he had no choice. "Okay," he thought, "we have number one in the chopper and a gun on her. Number two was in the open, two-thirds of the way to the chopper, and a gun on him." Two more bad guys were approaching the halfway point, with Mike Pierce and Steve Lincoln within 40 meters, and the last two subjects still in the house, with Louis Loisel and George Tomlinson in the bushes right and left of them. Unless the bad guys had set up overwatch in the house, one or more additional subjects to come out after the rest had made it to the chopper. Very unlikely, Chavez decided. And in any case, all the hostages were either in the open or soon would be. And rescuing them was the mission, not necessarily killing the bad guys, he reminded himself. It wasn't a game, and it wasn't a sport. And his plan, already briefed to Team 2's members, was holding up. The key to it now was the final team of subjects. Rosenthal saw the snipers. It was to be expected, though it had occurred to no one. He was the head gardener. The lawn was his, and the odd piles of material left and right of the helicopter were things that didn't belong, things that he would have known about. He'd seen the TV shows and movies. This was a terrorist incident, and the police would respond somehow. Men with guns would be out there, and there were two things on his lawn that hadn't been there in the morning. His eyes lingered on Weber's position, then fixed on it. There was his salvation, or his death. There was no telling now, and that fact caused his stomach to contract into a tight, acid-laden ball. "Here they come," George Tomlinson announced, when he saw two legs step out of the house. Women's legs, followed by a man's, then two more sets of women's, and then a man's. One subject and two hostages out. Two more hostages to go.
Ferkner was almost there, heading to the right side of the helicopter, to the comfort of Dieter